This is Mickey C for the Mother Cow podcast, introducing an interview I just did with Tony Goslin. Tony's a researcher, writer, journalist, and he's one of these people for me who makes me realise how little amount of information I actually retain. So without any further ado, I'll hand you over to the interview. Hope you enjoy it. So hi Tony, I first caught up with you, well not caught up with you, but seen some of your work on YouTube where you were talking about the Nazi origins of the EU. And I was quite interested in that. I was wondering if you would like to talk a little bit about that and then go on to sort of into like the Brexit and like what's happening with that now.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Tony Gosling. I'm a former BBC reporter, journalist. They actually called me a journalist. Well, I did a program with the BBC about 2008, which was looking into the, it was called The Conspiracy Files. It was a rather poor excuse for a program, but it was about the 7/7 London bombings. In fact, the BBC had this Mike Rudin as the series producer, as kind of come up with this strand called The Conspiracy Files, which really is a kind of conspiracy in itself. And they've done things on 9/11. They did the Diana assassination. They did the death of David Kelly, which was actually a program made by, this is the government scientist in the Iraq War, which is actually done by someone I know quite well at the BBC. And which wasn't actually a bad program, but it's a very it's not, they're not balanced documentaries. They're there really to kind of justify the official narrative, and this is characterizing a lot of what's going on in the mainstream media. I mean, I've seen big changes since I was working at the BBC. In fact, even while I was working there, the early 1990s, the old high standards of journalism really started to go out of the window, and the BBC started to become this kind of propaganda organisation. You can trace that back pretty much to Victor Rothschild and Margaret Thatcher's sacking of the Director General at the time in the 80s, Alastair Milne, whose son, incidentally, is this Guardian columnist, who's now the spin doctor for Jeremy Corbyn, having a terrible time. And there's a whole story in itself, the way that Corbyn is being misrepresented in the press in order so he can't get elected. But, so then I went on after the BBC and did, I suppose it's squatting land rights activism, environmental activism to do with social justice issues and housing. I had a lot of fun doing that and land occupations with a group called The Land Is Ours and a guy called George Monbiot, who's now quite well known as a Guardian columnist. And, and then since then, I came to Bristol and doing a weekly politics program on the radio here, where we every Friday we get a local politician in, either it's an MP or a councillor or whatever, to come and talk through the week's news, and also do investigative journalism. So I've done several quite extended investigations, particularly into, I mean, it's the stuff I'm not seeing on the telly, which frustrates me.
I think that's the same with a lot of people nowadays.
It's frustrating because, for example, you know, you start digging around the end of the Second World War, 1944, 1945, you'll find that there are some traitors within the Allies, and particularly obviously that, you know, were fighting at the time, the Brits and the Americans, who were actively cooperating with Nazis because they knew the Nazis had a lot of money and they could get their slice of it, you know, basically the Nazi gold. The whole of Europe was looted by the Nazis very, very systematically. They had actual army units whose specific job was to go and take any valuables back to Berlin, basically. And then after the war, I suppose, 1950s, we see the emergence of the Bilderberg Group. And this is something also, I think, which is completely taboo, really, within the mainstream press here in Britain, because it represents the embodiment of the traitors of World War II's empire today. I mean, they hoped to take all this money to be a secret influence network after the war, and then to control things from behind the scenes, like the Wizard of Oz kind of thing. And clearly people like me are trying to make sure they can't do that. If you look at the connections between the war and the Bilderbergs, there's the two main ones really being Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who he was the first chairman of the Bilderbergs. For 20 years he chaired it until the 1970s, until the Lockheed scandal. And he was a former SS officer. So that's a bit of obvious.
Yeah, a bit of a link there.
Thing that people, yeah. That you think the press might be interested in, but no. Mm. And,
the press have only recently admitted the Bilderberg even exists, really. I remember back in the 90s, it was sort of, when they used to get asked about it, it was like, oh, it doesn't exist.
Yeah, no, you're wrong. It was talked about in the 1970s, for goodness sake, and the 1980s, yeah, in the Financial Times, the Lombard column. I mean, it's been talked about in little bits and pieces, but then the guy, C. Gordon Tether, who wrote the Lombard column in the FT at the time, the Lombard column was supposed to be the sort of real insider's inside info about what's really going on in the city. Mm-hmm. And C. Gordon Tether started writing about Bilderberg in there, and then he was sacked. So there is a pamphlet around, which is the I think it's entitled something like the unpublished articles of C. Gordon Tether, because some of the articles he would as a journalist, this is very frustrating. He'd written an article about the real secrets of the city, mm-hmm. and never appeared in the paper. So, you know, I have that feeling quite a lot. I mean, I've been submitting stuff to Russia Today, for example, for my column there, and then they just send it back and say, oh, we're not interested in this, you know. And you think, hang on, you're not interested. You know, I've done an analysis of terrorism or something, and they're not, they won't publish it. So anyway, so now I do this program in Bristol, which is the main focus of my work, I suppose, every week.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of obviously it's been with the whole Brexit situation and that, and like the media, in my mind anyway, that it seems to be very tilted towards staying in the EU. Would you agree with that? Like the left wing media seem to have wanted us to stay in the EU. How do you think that? Because I think like Tony Benn, he was left wing and he sort of was anti-EU. So what do you think's going on there?
Well, you just said fell into a man trap there. I'll try and haul you out if you want, which is you said the left-wing media.
Yeah.
Well, the media is not left-wing. The media is what it is, and it's neither really right-wing nor left-wing. It has decided what is going to happen. And in fact, what they seem to do is to take the characteristics of worse characteristics from both left and right. Mm-hmm. So that is to say, the right and left can never really be properly, the two opposites where you find some kind of spectrum of in between views, because the left has got fatal flaws, which are really to do with this kind of nanny state destruction of the family and the idea that there's all this sort of gender equality. There's lots of stuff in there which is actually very divisive. Mm-hmm. And the same with the right. I mean, they call it equality, but then it's about saying that people can't be different. Well, people can be different. And also the other thing the left does is it does this thing where everything's got to be some sort of like mega equality. So nobody can have any kind of authority over anybody. You know, well, actually, you know, human society works quite well when really good people are in authority. But they seem to have also done a very good job on the left of, basically buying into all of the financial nonsense. And they're no good at understanding the way money works or land works. Land and money are the two most important subjects that anyone can actually get their heads around. And the left seems to be appalling at both of those, although there's a bit of activism around land rights occasionally and housing and that sort of thing. But then when you go over to the right, their fatal flaw is this idea that it's okay for people to be grindingly poor and that, you know, that there's no need for the state to intervene to look after people. I mean, we're now in the situation where with this right-wing government, that we've got a taking away of state support for the elderly. I mean, this is incredible, really. Social care. where people desperately need someone to come into their home and help them, say, for example, just go through their daily washing routines and things like that. And the right-wing government are saying, no, you can't have that person, effectively. They're just not giving the people the money for it. So, and they're refusing to tax the super wealthy, you know, which is absolutely obscene. So the media really has got its own agenda, and you're absolutely right to say it's anti-Brexit. I mean, everything you hear on the press is like derogatory of the whole idea that, you know, the European Union is not a good thing. And that's because, really, as I said, in the 1990s, you got a fair amount, a bit of balance before that. But after that, we've seen the media start to be used as a tool of the City of London. And just look at some of the most recent chairmen of the BBC. You've got Rona Fairhead from the Risk Committee of HSBC, has been the chairman up till now. It's just being replaced by a new chap. I can't remember his name, and he's from the Bank of England. Why have we got the City of London chairing the BBC? And I'll tell you why. It's because the City of London is run by criminals, a massive amount of fraud. I mean, no, in 2008, that was the biggest heist in history, where something like $700 billion had to be spent of public money in order to bail out these crooked banks and then their crooked auditors, you know, HSBC and Deloitte and people like this, just completely fixed the figures for the banks. And they robbed the public to the tune of, you know, something like £750 billion. And that's why we've got all these cuts going on now, because we've had this, the biggest heist in history. That all started again in the early 1990s with something called the Blue Arrow Trial. The Blue Arrow Trial was, which you can find detailed by Rowan Bosworth Davis and Ian Fraser. Rowan is a former Fraud Squad officer and now blogger and lecturer. And Ian Fraser, it works for the Sunday Herald in Scotland as a financial journalist. And they pulled apart this trial, the Blue Arrow Trial, which is where County NatWest Bank were doing what they call a rights issue for this company called Blue Arrow. And what they've done is they just completely fixed the figures as to how valuable this firm was. And so people bought into it. And then, lo and behold, the share price drops. And there was it was pretty well understood in the city that this had been a fraudulent rights issue. So there was a trial. And over several years, this was supposed to be fiendishly complicated. The Court of Appeal. So these several people from County NatWest Banks. I mean, the thing is, the Fraud Squad decided to prosecute it because they knew these were top, what they call blue blood bankers. And that if they can get these people for fraud, then everyone else will be wary. It's just sort of, I mean, this is how really good policing works. And the way, for example, Putin has run things at the Kremlin is you take out the top person, and it sends a message to all the other criminals. Like when he gave Boris Berezovsky 24 hours to leave Russia, this was sending a message to all the other oligarchs, because Berezovsky was the chief oligarch. You know, you can't be a criminal here. They started to behave themselves, and it's what would happen in any city now. You know, Liverpool, Newcastle, Manchester, or whatever. If you take out the top drug dealer in the city, it sends a message to all the other drug dealers. But of course, in Britain, I'm afraid at the moment, they just simply will not do that, because the top drug dealers are under massive amounts of protection by, for example, the international drug cartels, the secret services and people like that. And also, they're paying the police. Many of the police are on these on two salaries, one from the public and another from the drug dealers. So this tactic that the city were doing in the early 1990s was a really good idea, a really good way to do it. And what happened was that the trial, these three traders got a suspended sentence for this County NatWest fraud. Now, what Rowan Bosworth Davis said, who was in the police at the time as a Fraud Squad detective, he said that there was then an appeal, and it went to the Court of Appeal. And the Court of Appeal, if you can believe it, What they did is they just overturned the suspended sentences, so that these guys, not only did they get off and not go to jail, but they then overturned the conviction.
Right.
Even though the evidence was all there that they committed this massive multi-million pound fraud. So what Rowan says is the word came down from on high, no more prosecutions of blue blood bankers. And of course, from that moment in 1992 and 1993, the word has gone out that you can commit any kind of fraud in London. And that is the unique selling point of London and the City of London now, mm-hmm. is that it is a fraud central. If you want to do fraud, if you want to do false accounting, any kind of financial crime you want, London is the place to go. And they're actually actively sending out the message around the world that this is the way to do things. The other thing is, check out this book 000 by Roberto Saviano, because he's a former serious drug dealer, mm-hmm. guy involved in the drug trade. And in this book, he really spells out how the drug trade works. You can even get it as an audio book by Penguin, actually.
Right.
It's a fantastic read. And he's under the protection, apparently, 24 hours by three carabinieri in Italy. You know, so they've got the police, three armed police permanently protecting
right.
this guy.
Oh, yeah.
So he makes for an interesting author. So he says, okay, what's happening now is the big corporations, that is to say the ones based in all the big Western cities, you know, Berlin, London, Wall Street, mm-hmm. are basing themselves, they're modelling themselves on the narco cartels. So that is to say the most successful criminal gangs in the world are now have become the models for all the big corporations. And when a corporation, say, for example, like the bank HSBC, so when any of these big successful corporations nowadays is deciding how to do things, what they do is they look at how the drug cartels do it. And in fact, this chairman, getting back to the media, right, the chairman of the BBC, Rona Fairhead, what she was doing at HSBC was exactly this. So when you're having to take a risk, her question to the executives and the lawyers at HSBC was, okay, so if we get caught doing this, what's the worst that could happen?
Mm-hmm.
Right, so they're talking about taking loads of cash, for example, from the Medellin drug cartel or Mexican cartels, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
If they take that cash, what's the worst that can happen? Well, she's asked her staff at the bank, because she's a director, and they're saying, well, worst that could happen is we could get a fine and it might be this much. And she's then saying, you know, okay, so how does that compare to the money we would make if we were to do this crime?
And
it's like 100 times less they would be fined than the money that they will make.
So it's
called a no-brainer, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You just say, well, let's do the crime then.
Mm-hmm.
And that is now the spirit, if you want, and the mentality that has been, for the last 4 years or so, 3 or 4 years, has been running the BBC, which is, you know, the what can we get away with mentality and the criminal mentality. So you're talking about a criminal elite focused in London and now managing most of our mainstream media. Now, there are good people working in the BBC. It's what you would call a place of struggle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got the National Union of Journalists who are very active and trying to do a good job for the public, for the viewers and listeners.
Mm-hmm.
But the management are putting into key positions people who are basically what you would call a company men and company women. People who know where their bread is buttered, that they get their money from the government. Actually, the people pay it to the government, effectively regulates the BBC. Although they get their money from the people, people have got no real say in the program content on the BBC anymore. It's the government that decides.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we had just this week, we've had this extraordinary revelation about Laura Koonsberg, the BBC's political editor. Where she has interviewed Jeremy Corbyn last year on a very important point to do with the shoot-to-kill policy of the Labour Party, and whether police should be shooting people dead, or whether they should, you know, in a siege or a terrorist event or something,
mm-hmm.
or whether they should maybe shoot to disarm them or whatever. Anyway, so What Koonsberg did is she interviewed Jeremy Corbyn about this, and yet when she presented it on the 6 o'clock news, she actually presented it as if she'd asked him a different question. So there is Jeremy Corbyn giving an answer to a question which he was never asked. Now, this is deliberate propaganda, manipulation, and effectively it's a sabotage campaign against Jeremy Corbyn being done by Laura Koonsberg. Now, what did the BBC have to say about this yesterday? They congratulated Laura Koonsberg and defended Laura Koonsberg. So you can see where we're going here. I mean, You've effectively got a kind of a state dictatorship-style broadcaster
who are
there to transmit propaganda against the opposition. Mm-hmm. So that means that the opposition is going to find it very difficult to get elected. Actually, George Orwell, when he resigned from the BBC in 1943, he said that he didn't think the propaganda really worked. And that may be the case, that the more they try and smear Corbyn using the BBC, the Tory party in the city, mm-hmm. you may actually find the guy has a reasonably good chance of getting elected in a real election. Yeah. But, of course, this does have an effect. You know, it does definitely has an effect. Mm-hmm. And this is played out through Brexit and the whole European Union. Because the original question you asked is about the origins of the EU. Yeah. Okay, the Bilderbergs and Operation Market Garden. I mean, that's the stuff I've looked into as part of the program I do here in Bristol. So it goes back to 1943 to this thing called it probably goes back further than that. But this document that was produced in Berlin in 1942 it's called the Europäische Wirtschaftsgemeinschaft, which means European Economic Community in German. Mm-hmm. And it was drawn up by the Nazis, and it was drawn up to administer occupied Europe, right? So once the Nazis had occupied Belgium, France, etc., this is going to be the kind of program for the industries within occupied Europe. Mm-hmm. Then in the early 1950s, late 1940s, they brought in this thing called the European Coal and Steel Community, which was about the rebuilding of Europe. That then in the 1950s became the Treaty of Rome, which was the beginnings of the common market. And in the 1990s, that became the Treaty of Maastricht, signed by all these various government people. And isn't it interesting that you've got all these MPs moaning now, saying, "Oh, you know, you can't sign this, you can't sign this, it's all got to go through Parliament." Well, they've signed all the many of these various rights away without consulting the people over the years. You know, they haven't even gone to the people and said, "Okay, we had this referendum in the 1970s. Do we want to join the common market?"
Yeah.
But that was 2 or 3 years after we'd actually joined it. And so it was, do you want to get, I mean, Edward Heath and the Conservatives, who, you know, Heath now is under extreme suspicion.
Yeah.
He's not as a paedophile, certainly as an abuser of underage, sexual abuser of underage boys.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he signed us into the common market, and it was Harold Wilson that gave us an opportunity, the Labour leader in the 1970s, to say whether we wanted to stay in it or not, and we did, you know, 1975. So that's the history of it. But the early 1990s, we start getting a bit up to date, because that was Maastricht, and that was the reason Margaret Thatcher was booted out as Prime Minister, because leader of the Conservative Party, because she would not sign it. She said, "I'm not going to sign that piece of paper because it's signing away British sovereignty," effectively. She said her actual phrase was to 13 unelected bankers. Mm-hmm. So she didn't want to do that, and she refused. And that's why John Major it was that they brought to sign the Maastricht Treaty. Now, that meant a big, big change. I mean, that was political union, really. I mean, it was MEPs being sent. But the point being that even under a political union, I mean, you can see that the whole European project has been a con, because the people running
the shadows, hasn't it, really?
The European Commission, which actually runs it, is a is all run by failed politicians. All these people who are either removed via scandal, like Leon Britton was in the 1980s over the VI paedophile scandal back then, he then appears, he pops up as European Trade Commissioner. And that means he's in charge of the whole of European policy and decision-making to do with trade, right? And yet he's being kicked out because he is believed that he is found at the docks in Dover at the customs with child pornography. So he then is promoted to become a senior European politician. And the same sort of thing with Neil Kinnock, his complete failure in the Labour Party to win support with the public or with the party, really. He is then promoted to become a gravy train European commissioner. So it's an obscene setup, an obscene system. One of the guys I worked with in the 1990s, he was working in the European Parliament itself. He said, I've worked here for a couple of years and I've seen it. It will never work. It can never work because it was designed not to work for people. It's a system of control. And I think, you know, it's control freaks who've been magnetized, if you want, up to work for the media, who just spin everything all the time to make it look as if it's a terribly difficult thing to leave the EU. And the civil service and the government of the day, because the Conservatives are, you know, fairly savvy when it comes to intelligence matters and sovereignty and that sort of thing, and finance, that they've decided that Brussels is a pernicious thing, and that they've got rid of the sort of Cameronites within the Conservative Party now. They don't have any power anymore. And they have wrested back control from Brussels, and they haven't quite done it yet, but they're certainly on a mission to do it. And it's a very important mission too, because even if the Conservatives are in charge over here and we've got, you know, a kind of terrible oligarchical unfair elite, at least it means that we've got some sovereignty, because under the EU we had none at all.
Yeah. So where do you see the future of it going? Like, if it, what is the good side of the future and the bad side of the future for us?
Well, okay, look, the obvious thing is we're going to become more the puppets of America. You know, that's the first thing to say. The good sides and the bad sides. The good side will be it's going to be a rough ride. That's a bad side. Actually, it's a bad side. It's going to be definitely a rough ride because the financial oligarchy, the Goldman Sachs, the Kissingers, you know, these kind of major international banking cartels, the Bilderbergers, they hate the idea of Brexit. This is their little dream. They want to create a United States of Europe that they control and own. I mean, for example, you would have thought that there would have been lots of head scratching in 2008 at the Brussels and the EU over the financial crisis. Oh dear, what caused it and what can we do about it? Well, if they were in any way honest, they would have done that. They would have done something about it. They would have sorted out the regulation of the financial sector, but of course they didn't. What they did is they put a bunch of people in charge of the EU review who were the criminals in the first place. So you're not going to get anywhere with some policy like that. I say, the bad side, I think we've almost certainly got some kind of crash coming. You know, I mean, the thing is, it's difficult to know when, because at the moment, the elite are absolutely squeezing the poorest 95%, really, probably maybe even more, maybe more like 98, 99% of the population. They're stealing their wealth off of them through the financial manipulations to do with quantitative easing, right, and this money printing, because that money is not going to anywhere near to ground level. It's basically going to feed people who've got investment, got money to invest in the stock market. And it's tempting people to take their investments away from, say, for example, a safe bank account and put it on the stock market. Now, you know where that's going to lead, because eventually the stock market will be the place where everyone has to put their money in order to get a return on it, because the quantitative easing money, the printing money, is going into the stock market. And that's where the only place that you can make money if you've got money. And eventually, at some point, it's just going to go bang. And people will lose all that money because the stock market is gambling. You know, it's just like going down to William Hill and putting the money on a horse. At some point, you're going to lose. And in fact, it's like a casino. You're going to lose it all. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're doing, is they're trying to convince anyone who's got any savings to put it in the stock market, because interest rates in anywhere safe like a bank are so low. And people are going to get quite complacent. Oh, yeah, it'll be fine. And then one day it'll all be gone. And so that's definitely on the cards, Brexit or no Brexit. But I think that is the sort of thing that the financial elite are going to be punishing Britain with, some kind of, you know, financial hardship, whether it's a wider crash. Because, of course, we never had – everyone talks about 2008 as a crash. It wasn't. This is just a lie. This is a complete nonsense meme put out by the mainstream press. Oh, the crash. People like Robert Peston is supposed to know what he's talking about. Even Paul Mason, who used to work on Channel 4 News and BBC Newsnight. You know, people like this use this word crash. It wasn't. It was a bailout to avoid a crash. The crash is coming, and it's going to be far worse because we avoided it in 2008. That's the bad side, I suppose. The good side is that we will have much more control over our own affairs. I mean, you know, obviously under the Conservatives, that could mean that the poor just get kicked and kicked, and the rich get looked after even more. Although, you know, of course, that won't be forever. At some point, the British people will have a chance to change the system. We, in the background to all of this, we've got some very negative changes to the electoral system here in Britain, where you've got nearly 30 MPs who are elected in 2015. You know, time is getting on. It's coming on for 2 years now before these fraudulent elections, where 30 Conservative MPs submitted fraudulent accounts for their general election expenses. And by rights, the police, within a very short space of time, should have done their own investigations. Actually, what's happened is Channel 4 and the Canary and various other media have done the investigations for the police and said, look, these expenses are not right, and they've overspent. Oh, dear. Well, by rights, there should be by-elections in all of these 30 constituencies, because the MPs overspent, or the party overspent. What happened was central Conservative Party money was used in individual constituencies, and that should have been included in each constituency's return, but it wasn't. And so the fact that this hasn't happened really means that Theresa May doesn't have a majority, okay? So she's got a majority of about 8 or so at the moment, but there's 30 of those constituencies where there should be by-elections.
So is there any chance of that actually happening? Is there any chance of that happening, or anybody putting pressure?
Yeah, I think it's quite feasible if there's enough pressure put on in the right places. Look, this is really down to two bunches of people. It's the police and the Electoral Commission. And also, I might say, the Labour Party should be pushing for this. They should not miss any opportunity to point out that this is a fraudulent government that doesn't actually have a real majority. They've got 30 MPs who shouldn't actually be there, that there should be by-elections. In the meantime, the Tories have been fixing the system, so they've had some big changes to electoral registration, making it much more difficult for people to register to vote, which means people who are itinerant, maybe like moving quite a lot, like students, poor people, homeless people, etc., simply are not registered to vote. And so you've got literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people in Britain who are not registered to vote. And what they're doing is they're now this is a bit like the American system, where they've tried to gerrymander things over in the US, you know, in the run-up to George W. Bush's election. They're drawing up these new constituencies based on this, again, fraudulent electoral register with loads of people missing. So the people who are on the electoral register now tend to be either property owning or, you know, fairly permanent you know, reasonably well off. There's this whole massive underclass now of people who can hardly survive, who aren't on that register and aren't going to be able to vote. And they're drawing up the constituencies based on that. So there's a tremendous amount of fixing of the electoral system going on here in Britain right now.
All right, so with that in mind, then, do you think Corbyn can still win? Because there's a lot of thought that he can't, isn't there? And it just seems to be they're trying to make it that way by saying it, don't they? That seems to be the plan of the strategy he uses.
I mean, it doesn't seem to me he's got
a strategy. He's just kind of coping day to day. I mean, just listening to Prime Minister's questions this week, he's going on about Brexit and saying, isn't you doing the wrong thing? Actually, no, he's completely wrong to be doing that. They're doing the right thing by going for a hard Brexit because, you know, the European Union treats people as if they're just goods, you know, like a box of matches or a tub of pork, you know, a can of pork or something. That's the way they treat people. It's free movement of goods and services. But with that, it also goes free movement of people. Mm-hmm. And you can't do that. If you're treating people as if they're goods and services, then, you know, it's clearly you're going to have problems from your mentality, but secondly from people moving around Europe and just undermining pay and conditions. You've lost sovereignty if you have got no control over immigration, you know, at your borders.
Yeah.
And Corbyn has just simply not got this, and he's going on still as if, you know, what the conceder. He's been very badly advised. He's not
surprising to me that is the case, actually.
Well, it's not. I don't think it's a surprise because, of course, he's surrounded by a Labour Party officials who are mostly put there in the Blair years, and they're all Blairites. And he's also got a whole load of MPs who have also been selected in the Blair years and selected by Blairites. So he's almost in a minority, which is the majority in ordinary members of the Labour Party. So he's in a system which has been rather fixed up. But the other thing is, when he first started as Prime Minister, as the leader of the opposition at Prime Minister's Questions, he was doing this really good little thing, which was reading out a question from one of his constituents. Yeah, if you remember.
Yeah, I do.
Was, you know, Betty from Birmingham sent me in a question. She says, blah, 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 you know. Mm-hmm. And that was a really good, very, very sensible tactic, but he's just forgotten about it. He's just dropped it. The other thing is he's asking the same question six times, which is idiotic, really. I mean, it's a complete waste of, you know, what you've got is the opportunity there to ask six different pointed, well-aimed questions which undermine the credibility of Theresa May, but he's simply not doing it. So, you know, he's badly advised and he's just not doing what he needs to do. The other thing is he's got a massive multi-million pound private and BBC National London Media out to get him. I mean, I noticed the speech he did, his reboot, his post-Christmas 2016, post-New Year 2017, it was supposed to be a reboot. Now, I went online to find out what were the main points, because I didn't listen to the speech live, what were the main points he was making. I couldn't find a single article anywhere, not even in the Telegraph, the Mail, not even in the more left-wing press, like the Mirror or the Guardian. I couldn't find a single article which actually just spelled out what did Corbyn say? What was he saying? Mm-hmm. Everything was just kind of criticizing, critical. Now, in the face of that sort of media, I mean, of course, some people are going to notice this bias, you know, like they did with Red Ken, you know, when he was running the Greater London Council and Margaret Thatcher abolished it in the 1980s. Every other headline was Red Ken this, Red Ken that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he needs to be a bit smarter in first of all, at Prime Minister's Questions and in any kind of publicity. And secondly, the Labour Party needs to make a massive big thing of the bias at the BBC. For example, the Labour Party should be opposing the appointment of the banker to chair the BBC. Yeah, they should maybe get someone who's a retired, well-respected trade unionist, to
chair the BBC rather than a banker. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that they need to do is to take on this whole thing about electoral fraud and City of London fraud, mainly electoral fraud. I mean, they could be taking these things on, and they're just not. They don't have the capability to see the bigger picture and really to address I think the answer is probably Corbyn. If he carries on like this, he may not get elected. But then again, the British people are funny people. Sometimes they just think, you know, this guy is actually quite a decent bloke, and I think we're just going to vote for him anyway, even though he's had 4 years of propaganda against him.
Yeah. So do you think Corbyn should maybe take a leaf out of Trump's book? Because he seems to be going on the attack with the press, doesn't he? Like, because he's getting a rough ride. I don't know what your thoughts are on Trump, like, but he's sort of attacking the press back lately, isn't he? And I think that's going to be a feature of his presidency.
He's much smarter. The Republican Party are much smarter in the States. I mean, you know, what he did, for example, he went to the New York Times, didn't he?
Yeah.
And as soon as he'd won the election, first thing he did is he went to the New York Times. So I'm going to give you an exclusive. I'm here. I'll say, you know, and really sort of dares them to say, well, look, rather than just constantly attacking me and being part of the establishment, things are going to change. The wind is changing. Mm-hmm. And of course, it is changing against the neocons and the oligarchy in the West, who have been used to picking. I mean, this is the amazing changes of 2016. I mean, I think it's a really good blog for anyone, I would suggest, on any kind of really big international issues, which is where the London media tries to bamboozle us the most. It's called The Saker. That's S-A-K-E-R, The Saker. .is, and he's a former UN military analyst who was booted out of the UN because he had a difference of opinion. And he's done a really good article saying 2016, the year of Russia's triumph. And you see, he's not personalizing it to Putin because, of course, you know, actually, Russia is more of a democracy than Britain is. I hate to tell you, folks. They try and characterize Putin as in charge. If Putin was assassinated tomorrow, nothing would really change in Russia because you've got a whole load of people around Putin, like hundreds of them, who are there working in the interests of the people of Russia rather than just in their own self-interest as a sort of adjunct to their big business or banking, which is what we've got here in Britain. This was really brought about by the very brilliant move at the United Nations that Putin did at the end of 2015 by intervening in Syria. Yeah, so when the Russians came into Syria at the end of 2015, the writing was on the wall, really. And this, I think, is what's led to the neocons and the Western criminal elite being on the back foot in 2016, because the victory and the liberation of Aleppo, which was most amazingly, I mean, I've never seen such a propaganda campaign ever. Every newspaper, every TV station, night after night in the run-up to Christmas, saying, oh, isn't it terrible? Isn't it terrible? The terrorists are losing. Ah, well, hang on, no, the rebels are losing.
It's weird, isn't it?
What an amazing propaganda campaign that was. And I think most people around the country can look at this and they can see it. My God, they're supporting the terrorists. What's going on?
Well, they're starting
and people
to,
in the pub talking about it as well, you know. So this is where George Orwell was right. I think that sort of level of propaganda actually works against the media organizations and lowers them in ordinary people's credibility. And as a result of that and the Brexit vote and the Trump inauguration, I think we're entering a much more interesting era now where the criminal elite are not having it all their own way. Anyway, look, just to reiterate, yes, with the sort of path to Brexit, we're going to be much more friendly with the US, but that's dangerous, isn't it? Because we've got a right-wing government now just emerging in the US from Trump and the Republicans, which is, I mean, he's put the head of the biggest oil company in the world, Exxon, in charge of the State Department, Trump has. You know, there's also very much an aligning with the Israelis, with the Zionists and the settlement program of the Zionists in Israel, which is totally legal and designed to be a racist kind of apartheid. kicking the Palestinians off their land. So we've got that kind of brewing in the Middle East. Now, let's just take a look at that for a minute. You've got the Iran, who Trump apparently really doesn't like Iran, and he's not even going to say anything about what he thinks about Iran, right? And what's brewing up is this war in the Middle East between Israel and Iran. And it's quite clear which side the US are on. In fact, they may even, you know, with Trump, they may even though he said he doesn't want any more interventions, he may intervene there and he may even help kick that off. He's also said he believes that the Jewish Israeli government, I mean, I shouldn't say Jewish, really, because actually many of the Israelis are not really Jewish. I mean, from their original heritage, they'll call themselves Jewish. The Zionists, many ordinary Jews are not Zionists. In fact, most Zionists are, pro-Israelis, are Christians, the Christian Zionists. And there's really good work being done by Reverend Stephen Sizer, who's a London vicar, on his books on Zionism, explaining what it is. And this idea of moving the capital of Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, is one of the major objects of the Zionists. Now, of course, that is extremely provocative because East Jerusalem, the Chinese want Jerusalem to be the capital of Palestine. Originally, in the settlement in the 1940s and 50s, East Jerusalem, up until the Six-Day War, was occupied by Arab armies. You know, it was the whole idea was that Jerusalem has to be shared between Arabs and Jews, and then we can, you know, sort of get on, everyone can get on with each other. Of course, the British, when they were running things down there, found that quite difficult because, I mean, I've spoken to soldiers who were there, you know, and there was a massive Jewish terrorist campaign with the Stern Gang, the Irgun, and they wouldn't allow that. But the idea that you move the capital to Jerusalem is incredibly provocative, and Trump seems to be up for that. But you've got a conservative right wing government in Britain, and you've got a Republican right wing government in the US. Now, this is dangerous, right? When you've got both, you know, Britain is kind of going away from Europe, and you've got right wing government in Britain and right wing government in the US. It could mean war, and one of the reasons why the other European countries like Belgium, France, Germany might be quite glad to see the back of Britain is because we've always been seen as this kind of Trojan horse for the Americans.
Yeah.
And the Americans always want to have a war, but never on their back doorstep.
Mm-hmm. But so with what you're saying about Trump and Iran and that, though, obviously if Clinton had got in, I mean, she was quite heavy into a warmongering. Do you see Trump being like better or just different than what Clinton would have been? Because Clinton seemed to be heavily involved with the whole Syria, Libya thing.
Yeah, she certainly was. Yeah, and I don't think there's actually any going to be a great deal of difference. Maybe the only rhetoric we've had from Trump really about the international stuff is that he wants to intervene less. So that means potentially that we won't see quite so much as we would have done with Hillary. I think she was a kind of almost like a kind of Lady Macbeth figure. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's so greedy for power.
Yeah.
She was prepared to kick her Democratic Bernie Sanders in the teeth and cheat her way into getting the nomination, just so that she could have a chance to be president, even if it meant that because people didn't like her, they know she's got a crooked track record, it may propel Trump to victory. So I would suggest that actually Hillary Clinton is the main person responsible for Trump winning.
Yeah, well, I would definitely agree with that because it was like, it wasn't much of a choice, really, was it? I mean, Trump said some decent things, which make you think he maybe could do some good things, but then he's a bit of an unknown from my point of view.
But he's also surrounded himself with these neocons and Goldman Sachs people. So he's going to be sitting around the cabinet table in a minority of one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the part of the problem here. You know, he's going to be president, but is he going to be able to actually do what he wants? And in fact, it might even be that those people round on him. I mean, the neocons have already started this whole thing, this whole business of, you know, Russia. Russia has got, this is what they said, isn't it, last week? Russia has got intelligence on Trump, and they may use it. You know, this is really interesting, the way that this is spun out by the London press uncritically. And by the way, It's only a handful of news wire services that almost all the newspapers use to base all their news on. Things like the Press Association, Associated Press, Reuters, Agence France-Presse. There's a handful of them. And they all say the same thing, but all say the same lies. And everyone just treats it as the truth in international news. I mean, not so bad national news, but international news is totally managed. There's no kind of critical anything going on there. I mean, just as an example, we had this, they've decided this MH370, this plane that disappeared a couple of years ago, heading off for China from Kuala Lumpur, a Malaysian Airlines plane. You know, the MH370 disappeared. And they've said, oh, we've given up looking for it. Well, this is an absolute farce because they've been looking for it in totally the wrong place.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if you've been following.
Is that the one that's got something to do with the patents? Like, were the people on board who are a market?
Yes, that's the question. I mean, I'm not really interested in who was on board, actually. Mm-hmm. I'm much more interested in, as someone that's worked in aviation, I'm interested in what evidence there is about where this thing went and where it landed. And first of all, we saw massive news management of that story, an unbelievable scale. For anyone that's an insider in journalism, in the mainstream, worked in the mainstream press, you can see this. It's first of all, they said, oh, it's just disappeared. And then we saw a release of the military radar traces. Well, what happened? The plane did not just disappear. It turned around and started going off in the opposite direction. And it was following the zigzag pattern, right? It would go in a zigzag.
Right.
And that was only because we got somebody in the military in Malaysia release the radar trace. The government, I don't think, wanted to do that. And then we got this other extra. So it basically doubled back on itself across Malaysia and headed out over the Indian Ocean, not into towards China at all. First of all, I'd say that zigzag is exactly what, if you go onto the paths of the jets on September the 11th attacks in the States, you'll see exactly the same thing. These planes are zigzagging, like they're tracking this way, then that way. This is a very interesting, planes don't, airliners never fly like that. Yeah. They don't zigzag. Military aircraft do. Military jets do, because they, just like in the Second World War, they would be heading, say, to Paris for to bomb Paris, maybe. Actually, I don't think they really did bomb Paris much, but say they'd be heading to, I don't know, Kiel or a military port in the north of Germany, all these massive, you know, hundreds and hundreds of bombers from Britain.
Right.
And then they would change direction and then be heading somewhere else so that the Nazis didn't know where they were going.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a military thing where they zigzag. So that if, say, for example, the planes are heading in X direction and then they go out of radar range, you have no idea where that plane is going to go. Yeah, mm-hmm. So you can't just follow a straight track. So this is what is very suspicious about that MH370, which nobody at all has ever mentioned, I've ever seen anywhere in the international press. This is what I mean by news management. So, then we have sightings of that plane at the Maldives. Several people said, oh, we saw this airliner flying very low over the sea, you know, off the coast. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened straight after that, and that was only a few days after it disappeared, because it was a weekly paper in the Maldives that came out and said this. And then there's all these denials issued. Now, how can you issue a denial from a desk in New York or London or Washington of Associated Press or whoever to deny that somebody in the Maldives saw a plane? It's complete rubbish. And yet those denials squashed that story. So the story got out for about an hour, and then these denials came out. No, it can't be. No. It wasn't. They didn't see it. And this is where it becomes really obvious, right? That jet was almost certainly flying, if it was passing the west of the Maldives going south to Diego Garcia, which is this secret American base, which is actually owned by the Brits, but the Brits have leased it to the Americans. And also there was another clue, supposed clue, that came out last year, that I think it's Asuncion Island, just off the east coast of Africa, that apparently they found some debris from this jet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they found that debris, I think it's a year or something like that after the plane had, maybe even 18 months after the plane had so-called crashed. And they used it as evidence that, well, the sea here drifts in this westerly direction. Well, I can tell you, right, you look at the speed of the sea currents, if the plane had come down where they said it would take about a month and a half for the debris to drift that in that direction. What they're asking us to believe is it actually took a year and a half for it to get there. So somebody has placed that debris there deliberately to make it look as if, you know, all these kind of obvious things about an airliner which has disappeared with hundreds of people who also disappeared. You know, these are very important facts which we are never ever told by the internet. So it's the international press which I think is the most controlled.
So what do you think actually happened to that plane then, or what's the theory behind
it? It was almost, okay, very simple, two explanations. One, it was hacked. That is to say, you get an aircraft or a ground station, probably an aircraft that can fly alongside it or nearby or maybe even 100 miles away, you know, so they can't be seen visually by the passengers or the pilot, mm-hmm. can hack into that plane and steer it and tell it where to go, you know, so the pilot's got no control. Now, these systems exist to override hijackers, okay? Yeah. So they will be treating the pilot as if he was a hijacker.
Mm-hmm.
So they could have flown it any way they wanted to. Mm-hmm. The other possibility is that the military came through to the pilot on the radio and said, and basically told him where to go. So, hi, you know, we've just come through to a civilian pilot. This is such and such from the military.
Mm-hmm.
There's been an emergency of some sort, so you can't fly to China. You have to follow this track. And mm-hmm. they would have told him to fly there, and he would have just done it. I mean, you could... If you come through as the military on a recognized military frequency to a civilian airline pilot, they will do exactly what the military tell them to do. So, you know, neither of these two, for me, as someone who's worked in the business of both media and aviation,
mm-hmm.
You know, obvious answers, neither of those two have been even mentioned in any of the mainstream press. The possibility of hacking really not been looked at all. The other possibility of, you know, military coming through on the radio and just telling the pilot what to do hasn't been looked at either. The idea is it's some sort of kind of Bermuda Triangle mystery, you know.
Yeah.
But that's absolute rubbish. This plane almost certainly landed somewhere. And the thing that the real smoking gun, I suppose, has been, it's nothing to do with this bit of debris which was found in Asuncion, probably placed there by a criminal who's involved in killing all these people or, you know, whatever's happened to them. You know, the real smoking gun is this information came out from Rolls-Royce about the how long the jet was actually flying for something like 5 hours after it was supposed to have disappeared. And that was never supposed to come out. Rolls-Royce came out with it. The Malaysians, would you believe, the Malaysian airline officials even denied it. Said, no, this is not true, but quite clearly it was true. And that gives the plane plenty of time to have flown down to... In fact, I would suggest that Rolls-Royce probably know exactly what was the geographic GPS location of the plane when it did stop, you know, when they did turn the engines off. It may have been Diego Garcia, but they just can't tell anyone. But they have given as much of a clue as they can, saying that the engine switched off 5 hours after.
So why the cover-up with it, though? Why the big secret about it?
Well, because this is almost certainly some sort of military operation, and the military are not, that's the US military probably, in collaboration with other NATO militaries like the British, you know, and that is not going to find its way into the civilian news stream. Yeah, so it's a secret. You're never going to find out. In fact, the same sort of thing has happened with the MH17. That's that airliner that came down in...
the Ukraine one, yeah.
The same exact thing has happened there, because what you've got is sightings of a Ukrainian, they think anyway, a Ukrainian fighter jet in the area, which was reported by the BBC in the BBC's Russian or Ukrainian service, whatever it is over there. And then they then took that report down, and then some people thankfully saved it, you know, but it was a video, an interview with people on the ground who'd seen a fighter jet Now, that, you know, the fact that they've removed that just shows you that they're covering it up.
Yeah.
And on the wider question of the investigation afterwards, the panel that's investigating it includes Ukraine. Now, the way it works with the with a kind of criminal disclosure of an investigation like that is all parties, that is to say the Malaysians, the Australians who were looking for it too, the British who got the cockpit voice recorder, everybody involved has to agree before any information is released. And of course, the Ukrainians are not going to agree to anything. They haven't even released the audio of the air traffic control, which is astounding.
Mm-hmm.
So the Ukrainians were definitely involved in shooting that plane down and killing all those people. I don't admit much doubt at all in my mind, particularly because of all the spin that was put on, it must have been the Russian rebels. Didn't even have one of these things that could have shot them. So, you know, it is obviously, this obvious lies involved in there. And the reason that Malaysia in both those cases was chosen, I think, is pretty clear, because the Malaysian Airlines and the Malaysian government has prosecuted the Bush and Blair and the Israelis for war crimes in absentia. So these people cannot visit Malaysia. There's been war crimes trials against there are various people, including senior Israelis. And if they ever fly to Malaysia, they'll be arrested as they get off the plane.
Right.
And so that's why I think the Malaysians have been targeted. And it's also, I'm rather proud in a weird way that it's an ex-British colony, you know, because we've left in a small way there a sense of justice,
right.
You know. That is the only place in, well, one of the only places in the world that's bothered to take international law seriously and make sure that people like Kissinger cannot go there, you know.
Yeah. Well, that would be a shame. It would be better if it was more countries like that, wouldn't it, really?
Well, if all countries, I mean, there is no proper international law, and the Russians have really just enforced it, you know, because they were going to lose their bases in the Eastern Mediterranean in Tarsus in Syria, and they would have lost their base in the Crimea if the West had had its way in the Ukrainian. In the Black Sea fleet would have gone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that would make such an enormous change to the geopolitical situation that the Arab-Israeli crisis to have no Russian warships anywhere near the area, no Russian ships in the Mediterranean or the Black Sea. You know, that would have just completely tipped the balance of power. So the Russians couldn't allow Syria to fall. So.
Yeah.
That's been the big tipping point. In a way, you can go back to the Book of Acts in the Bible. And I mean, I'm a Christian Quaker, and I do take some of this stuff quite seriously. And you look at what happened with Saul on the road to Damascus and his conversion to Christianity. He was persecuting Christians, and he had this little sort of conversion where the scales fell from his eyes and an angel vision appeared. And I think that's what we're seeing today, a kind of echo of that from the past. On the road to Damascus, the world has realized that, you know, in Syria, that this whole thing of regime change is no more. That policy out of the door. And obviously, they're going to try in places like Gambia and in places like Africa, etc., and this will happen. But, you know, it's been, I think, quite a real awakening for Western populations to see how wicked their governments have been in just simply taking over these countries.
Yeah.
And the thing is, as the criminal elite in the West are blocked by the Russians, then they start looking at home and think, right, well, you know, what can we do? I mean, look at what's happened. I mean, this has happened in the US, hasn't it? Is that the attack on democracy in America and the attack on Donald Trump, you know, so they can't beat the Russians, but they can bash Donald Trump. And that's what they've been doing. The idea that they're releasing, you know, the Russians have got this intelligence on Donald Trump. They're going to tell all these kiss and tell stories from his past and his wife and that. Well, actually, that isn't the Russians that are going to do that.
That's the criminal elite
in the West. And I imagine right this minute, there are all sorts of documents being copied in the CIA, which are then being passed to neocons in America that can then use that information in the press against Trump. So yeah, the media is the in a way it's like the nervous system of humanity, mm-hmm. and the criminals have got control of a lot of it now, including parts of the BBC. Laura Koonsberg, there's really no way that she should ever appear on the television again if she's at which she's been proved to fabricate reports smearing the opposition leader of Britain. How on earth can anyone take her seriously again? The same with Cathy Newman on Channel 4 News. She smeared the Muslims, by saying that she'd been ushered out of a mosque and tweeting about it. And there was this news story that went around the country, isn't it terrible, these Muslims. And then it was shown by CCTV that there'd been nobody anywhere near her. She just walked out of the mosque of her own accord. So these people are fabricating an Islamophobic lie in very much the same way as the Nazis in Nazi Germany were fabricating the anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, Jewish hate lies. And the bigger picture really is we've got an attack on people of faith. Back then it was the Jews. Now it's the Muslims. In the future, quite clearly, it's going to be Christians. All of this attack is focused around this Knights Templar crusade against Jerusalem. And Donald Trump, it looks, is going to be co-opted into being part of that.
Right. So, just to round it all off, going back to what you were saying before about, it seems to be working against them, their propaganda, that people are just, it's like the boy who cried wolf, isn't it? Once they get found out so many times for lying, people just don't believe it. So where do you see, the fight, with the mainstream media and the alternative media? Do you see the alternative media taking over in any way, shape or form? It's definitely got stronger over the last few years.
First of all, you've got Alex Jones, haven't you, who's mm-hmm. completely sold out now. He's become part of these, most like he's forgotten he was really responsible for 9/11. He always was actually a bit of a sort of fraudulent doppelganger counterfeit version of Bill Cooper, William Cooper, who was a talk show host in the States. He was actually ex-military intelligence, and he was doing a fantastic job. And Alex Jones turned up as a kind of fake version of him. He's clearly got a very pro-Zionist agenda, pro-Christian Zionist agenda. He's lying about all this stuff to do with every time anything happens bad to Israel, America suffers, so we've got to just, it's some sort of God-given thing that we've got to protect the Israeli government. And yet he's forgotten that all of the many of the clues for who was behind the 9/11 attacks actually lead back to Israel. This is a brilliant article, 9/11 Israel Did It, All the Proof in the World, which you can find on Wikispooks and various other good websites. So he's forgotten all that. So you've got fake alternative media too, like Alex Jones.
Do you think it was fully fake, though? A few years ago, I used to really watch a lot of Alex Jones, and he's very much supporting
exactly
Trump.
The normal thing is you suck everybody in, and then you fleece them. This is what normal con men do. So Jones is just one of those, he does good stuff over the years, but then of course he would never have an audience if he hadn't. And now he's cashing all his chips in with the neocons. Effectively, it's like Fox News on steroids now, the Alex Jones thing. Anyway, so he's not alternative, So yes, there is internet, there is a bit of social media, there's evidence that's being, I think clearly the thing which is going to bring people together outside the media world, in the real world, is like happened in Egypt in the Arab Spring when they switched off the internet there. So people just came out on the streets.
Yeah.
People come out on the streets and they talk to their neighbours and they take action in that way. The most important thing, I think, is that people coalesce around the right issues. The right issues are money reform and land reform. Mm-hmm. And look at the Article 50 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights. This is all around people's basic dignity, basic rights, mm-hmm. and it's all around making sure that everybody has a roof over their head, everybody has water, everyone has food. And if a government can't deliver that, which it clearly can't in Britain at the moment with all these people having to go to food banks, charity to get something to eat to feed the kids, then the government isn't worth having. Let's just organise amongst ourselves and that's I think is where things are going to go here in Britain, is that we'll see that kind of mentality happening on the streets. We already see it here in Bristol, actually. Yeah. People helping each other out rather than expecting the government to manage things. And that will coalesce into some, either within the Labour Party potentially, or else within some other kind of political movement. Otherwise, you know, we're heading definitely for a kind of dictator. It's almost as if we grew up in my generation in the 1960s, 70s and 80s in a country which was having a brief respite from the normal kind of dictatorship of humanity after World War II, you know. So after the Second World War, there was a little bit of, you know, we had the Beatles and things like that. We had a bit of fun. Yeah. Now it's back to normal, you know. It's back to the Sheriff of Nottingham running things. And, you know, so we're going to have to fight these oligarchs again.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I like a good Star Wars analogy. Like, and I see it as sort of like that in the first Star Wars, where the Death Star is coming around the planet and the rebels are trying to blow up the going down the tiny trench and find the sweet spot to blow it up. You know what I mean? And just this, like, there's like seconds either side of who's actually going to win it. You know what I mean?
Main thing is to realise that much of the mainstream national press is effectively psychological warfare. It's being conducted by psychological warfare officers. Some of the, you know, these people who are trained by the military to win wars by lying, basically, but through the press, etc. Like, you know, for example, with Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. Just as Gaddafi was making his last stand, the various news channels around the world were putting out, oh, he's just lost. So that just when he was most needing the people to come and help him, everybody is fooled into thinking that Gaddafi's lost and he's disappeared and he's had it, you know. Mm-hmm. So they use the media in this way, and it is psychological warfare. If you get trained at Chick Sands in Bedfordshire to become a psychological warfare officer for the British Army, you work there for a couple of years, and then, you know, Al Jazeera come and tap you on the shoulder and say, "Well, we're going to add a zero to your salary. Do you want to come and work for us?"
Christ, yeah. Oh well, that's absolutely amazing.
Anyway, I want to just say my website. Bilderberg.org, and which is my old website, which has got links to all the main stuff I do nowadays as well. Front page. Plus, there's loads of research on there people can dig through, which I dug up in mostly in the 1990s about the Bilderbergs and all sorts of others. And, you know, the origins of it, that's what I was interested in, particularly once I found out it was started, you know, by a former SS officer. Yeah. Then you could go to have a look at my 9/11 forum, which is 911forum.org.uk, which is where we have discussions about any kind of big events that happen. Plus, for example, the cashless society, they're just talking about starting to charge us to use cash points, which is really cheeky. Yeah. I mean, this, of course, should be infrastructure managed by the government, nationalised. And it's not. It's a bunch of private banks that are just playing with us, you know, and they're now saying, oh, you're going to have to pay us to get money, your money, out of a cash point.
Yeah.
You know, where, because we've sacked everybody in the banks and we've moved your banks away. I mean, this is the this is the sharp end of the oligarchy here. Yeah. You know, telling you you've got to pay to get your own money. You know, and what else is there? Yeah, this, so the weekly show.
Yeah,
that's 911forum.org.uk. Which people can just register at and contribute and share their views. And then there's thisweek.org.uk, which is our weekly politics show, two-hour politics show. There's another one I do as well, which is dialectradio.co.uk online. Right. As you can see, I'm afraid I'm not on the BBC anymore. Yeah. You have to go online to find my stuff, you know, or else if you're living in Bristol, you can pick us up on FM on a Friday.
All right, so you can get all them links to them shows through your website, yeah?
Yeah, Bilderberg.org is a sort of central point, but the best place, if you want to listen to some of the radio, is to go to thisweek.org.uk, and you can download a podcast every week if you haven't managed to listen to it live there.
Right, that's absolutely brilliant. Okay then, Tony, cheers for coming on and sharing your views. Really appreciate it.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Okay, cheers, man. Speak to you soon.